Hi, it's Nicole.
And Tiffany.
Welcome back to Ryersonian This Week.
Today, we're going to talk a little bit about what happens when decisions are made behind closed doors.
Mm-hmm.
I have a story on how Regent Park residents are reacting to Toronto Community Housing's new method of choosing tenants for their buildings.
And I have a story on the folks being left behind with the changes to sex ed and Indigenous curriculum across Ontario. Stay with us.
Doug Ford's government has made changes to the Ontario elementary school curriculum, and those changes have been met with strong reactions. Lesson plans were reverted to a 1998 version. Those in favor of that choice prefer it, especially because it leaves things like sex ed in more of a gray area, using less description and glossing over hot-button issues like consent. Those against using the old curriculum think that youth need to know about things like that as early as possible. And they take issue as well with the omission of units on Indigenous issues and reconciliation. Here's Nicole with more.
2, 4, 6, 8, don't go back to 98. We want sex ed. We want sex ed. No ignorance, no hate. Don't go back.
I'm wide awake, but you're a nightmare. I can't escape, I'm seeing you.
Part of what my core feelings are around all of these curriculum shenanigans is that on a symbolic level.
That's Samantha Viorel. She's a spunky, kind of unorthodox sex educator who, after years of working with groups like Planned Parenthood, recognized an opportunity to deepen people's knowledge about sex and health. She talked about intoxication, sex, and consent on Wednesday at Ryerson's SLC during an event she calls Pleasure Principle. It was an hour of her signature approach, sex ed trivia games, and it created a space on our campus to discuss something that's being talked about all over the city and the province right now. Sex education. And questions like, what aspects of sexual health should we talk about with kids in school? And how old is old enough to introduce the idea of sexual consent? High school students protested outside of Queen's Park last Sunday because they're angry that elementary school students, the generation behind them, are now back to learning a curriculum that was drafted in 1998. And the old curriculum cuts out topics that some of today's high schoolers think elementary school kids need to know. Sex and consent is at the top of that list, and the sex part of the curriculum is what a lot of groups both for and against the new curriculum are zeroing in on. But what you just heard Samantha say about symbolism interestingly sums up what the battle is all about. Of course, education is a part of it, but it's also a fight about identity and which people and which topics are validated by having the honor of being talked about and included in the curriculum.
As a trans person, like as someone who is like two-spirit and trans masculine and like medically transitioning, I didn't know what transness was.
That's Olson Crow, a 20-year-old student at Ryerson.
They found out what transness was from watching Degrassi. So we didn't talk about queerness. I also went to like a Catholic high school. We didn't talk about transness. We didn't talk about like anything like that.
What ends up happening when we only talk about or educate around sexual health in a heteronormative framework is that folks are excluded and therefore much needed information or education that might be more specific or have those nuances to, you know, men have sex with men relationships or women have sex with women relationships or, you know, men have sex with trans women relationships. Like those little nuances are erased, right?
What Samantha just mentioned is something Olson and many other students have lived the consequences of. Not being reflected in the sexual education curriculum growing up left Olson to figure out their trans identity largely solo. I asked Olson to imagine what they think it would have been like to learn about the existence of the trans community in elementary school.
So I think it would have, like, caused a lot less, like, I don't know, like, identity trauma and, like, self-doubt. There was no supports in my community. And, like, if this was worked into the curriculum and, like, more educators were aware of it, like, that wouldn't only be education about people's own identity, but it would also be a support space because, like, folks would already know what you're talking about.
What schools teach each generation of children becomes the baseline for what's normal in society, the reference point for what's acceptable, what's to be celebrated, and what's to be remembered as something we shouldn't repeat.
When we have comprehensive sexual health education for everyone, not separating boys and girls in grade one and being like, you're going to learn about periods, you're going to learn about breastfeeding, like none of that. When we actually have conversations, learn communication with each other, then you can identify situations sooner and trust your own instincts sooner and have the tools to communicate sooner. And the way we talk about intoxication culture and how we understand consent and intoxication, all those things can be taught in like communal environments. And then that becomes the norm. And I think that that kind of goes back to that piece about, is there a place in public education for sex education? And that's why the answer is still yes. You know?
So let's step away from sex ed for a second and take a look at another way that what we learn in the classroom has a generational impact that shapes the course of people's lives. Here's Cara MacArthur, a Cree woman in her 30s who works with a group called Indigenize Our Minds. She grew up right here in Toronto, went to public schools, and she told me most of what she learned about major events in Canadian history, like the 60s scoop, she learned from her mom. Her schools barely touched the subject. So I asked her a similar question to the one I asked Olson earlier. How would your life have been different if you and your classmates had learned more about Indigenous history in school?
Oh, man. I wouldn't have felt so invisible. I find that the lack of representation in the education system through, like, the curriculum makes Indigenous people feel very invisible. I feel like it affects your sense of self because you're not seeing yourself in anything that you're learning, but then also I find that it can really affect your self-esteem as a young person because it kind of, whether you're aware of it or not, on a subconscious level, it's like you, it just kind of gives you this feeling like you're not worthy enough to be, you know, in your school plans and in your lessons or be worthy enough to have people talking about you. And I feel like that kind of creates a toxic foundation for a lot of youth.
Something that's made me really frustrated is that everyone's talking about the sex ed curriculum, which is great, but no one's talking about the changes to Indigenous education curriculums, which, to be fair, is like super lacking. And even the updated curriculum is super lacking. Like as an Indigenous person, my father is Haudenosaunee Mohawk and my mom is Métis. I am an Indigenous person and I didn't know anything about my own culture growing up because our schools like fundamentally fail us. The only thing I can remember doing in elementary school was like we had to like build it, like it was like build an Indigenous village and like pick a tribe and you're gonna build their village. So I picked like the Mohawk village because I'm like this would be like my own people's village, LOL. And then, like, going into class and watching, like, all these white kids have, like, figurines of, like, really racist portrayals of Indigenous people and getting, like, A pluses.
So the younger ones, I don't think it's that much more different. And then, too, from just working with youth, it's seems just on like the level of like health, whether it's mental health or anything like that, they're not represented. So then therefore they're not seeking out the care that they need. And I don't know, I think this idea of like removing consent from the curriculum, it's just, I don't know. I feel like it's one of those things that's being put in place to protect men and to protect their power. And it's like disempowering people from a very young age is why you have like what's going on now, like why people are only now coming out and saying that they were assaulted in their like late 40s, 50s.
Here's Samantha, the sexual health educator from before.
I
And at the level of like being someone who educated youth, primarily youth and women, I think there will always be room for disruptive education around it. In the current political climate, is there a failure? Yes.
Worry about like the little kids who may not have the benefit of like the slightly expanded curriculum that you did?
Yeah, it like definitely stresses me out a bit, especially because like for a lot of the youth that I met in care, a lot of us didn't know we were in dangerous situations until we had the words to prove that. So I think like I worry a lot for youth who are in like unsafe situations at home, and like I definitely worry for like young trans and queer youth, because we know statistically that like trans youth know they're trans, most trans people, by before the age of 10. So that's when these kids would have been learning this information, where now they're going to have to like repress their identities because they're not sure what's up with them or what to call it, or think they're abnormal or weird because they don't know that there's other people who feel like them. So I think like with Indigenous curriculum being cut, like I think that's also going to be dangerous because we already have Canadians not caring about the unlawful deaths of Indigenous people like Tina Fontaine and Colton Bushy. So if that's already where we're at, I think pulling back even some of the little amount of education that we have is going to be way more dangerous.
On Tuesday, the Ryersonian Morning Update reported over 3,000 applications were submitted for the 75 new community housing units at Regent Park. We decided to follow up on this story and got in touch with Waleed Kogali Ali, Regent Park resident and councillor hopeful for Toronto Centre, Ward 13. We wanted to find out to what extent the Toronto Community Housing Corporation's new high-rise was meeting Toronto Centre's needs. Here's Tiffany.
Toronto Community Housing stopped accepting applications for its new high-rise at Regent Park this past Wednesday. 110 River Street's 20 singles and one two-bedroom unit is reserved for seniors. The remaining 17 two-bedroom units and 37 three-bedroom units will be reserved for folks who win the luck of the draw of TCHC's new lottery system. This system has been tried once before, the last time TCHC formally made a call out for new tenants back in January 2018. Waleed Kogali Ali and his fellow residents have a bone to pick with this lottery.
You don't understand the damage that's been just caused by this lottery system. Distrust in the system and folks who are making decision-making is actually the problem, and I hope people understand that, because, you know, when you have folks in leadership position, you know, whether they are, you know, managers at TCHC, whether they're going to be city councilors, when you abuse the trust by basically putting forward a model that people don't even have support for, that's an issue.
I should mention that Kogali is running for councillor in Toronto Centre. He was on the pod a few weeks ago. But to be fair, Kogali does think that TCHC is doing its best.
You know, we have the service workers on the ground that actually are responsive in many cases, but I think it's the senior management that's been out of touch. You can't be introducing policies that are not one, supported by community, two, being perceived as fair, because, you know what, there's no validity in that process altogether because there's no community support.
But the new lottery system was actually the way that TCHC and the City of Toronto tried to make it more fair. The old system had folks physically waiting in line, and it was first come, first serve. You could wait in line for days, only to wait for a unit for years.
So that would mean, for example, if September 3rd was the first day we'd be accepting applications, then there'd be a lineup out the door, maybe for several days, for people to get on that list.
That's Bruce Maloke, Director of Strategic Communications for TCHC.
Because of the first come, first serve, and it's considered not to be fair, because some people could, you know, pay somebody to stand in line, or they could afford to stand in line for 3 days or whatever we chose to do to get
up at the top, and others couldn't because they had to work or whatever. So it was considered the random draw was a fair way to do it.
He says the city is abandoning the old waiting list because the lottery was adopted as a fairer system. But Kogali doesn't see it that way.
I have never heard so many complaints ever about anything like that lottery system. It's not fair. And the fact that the process is so secretive as how applications are considered, and worse, it was a process not put forward by residents of TCHC, right? This was a process, put together by management, and is actually being perceived as a way where people can cut the list. So I think it's crucial for us to take a step back and consult the community first about the system that they will support so that we can garner the trust and confidence in decisions being made for our communities.
No one at the City of Toronto was available to comment on how it ensured fairness before the release of today's episode.
What would we consult them on? And actually, we don't choose who our tenants are. Like, it's all managed, centralized list by the City of Toronto through their agency.
TCHC's affordable rentals criteria is on their website. It's based on your annual income and on an occupancy standard. Basically, the occupancy standard says if you're a single person, you're automatically ineligible for a three-bedroom you put yourself down for.
But everybody who's eligible goes into the draw and has an equal chance of being chosen. It's generated through a computer program, so it's random.
Right.
And once you're offered the unit, and you go through the process of making sure that you're eligible and that you can sign a lease, like any landlord, they will check your credit and make sure that you can pay your rent.
While Kogali welcomes the new Toronto community housing, he thinks the city now needs to pivot towards supporting families that live downtown in Toronto Centre.
What I'm worried about is we're having too many folks, and families specifically, who are homeless and in our shelters. And that's something that concerns me, not just as a candidate, but as a resident of the city. What type of city are we trying to really build? Are we building an inclusive, affordable, and a prosperous world-class city? And if we are doing that, we need to be investing in the right type of housing as well.
Almost 4,000 households submitted applications for the 75 units at 110 River Street.
So that's my only critique, but I also applaud the folks, who advocated to make sure that we have senior housing, because I think that's crucial as well.
The lottery will take place next week at the earliest.
That's it from us this week. Enjoy your reading week, Ryerson, and we will be back next Friday, October something.
October 19th.
Okay.
Angela Glover was here for technical and emotional support, and you heard us today. Nicole Edwards, me, Tiffany Lam, we're the ones who produced your stories.
Today's final word goes to Waleed Kogali Ali about what happens when decisions are made behind closed doors. See you soon.
I think we need to better understand what that means, right? And what's the actual, what's the externalities that come with those decisions as well. So I think it's crucial for us to take a step back and consult the community first about the system that they will support so that we can garner the trust and confidence in decisions being made for our communities.